The day is Monday, March 18th, 2019. The hosts are Scott Frazier, Alyssa Walker, and Hayes Davenport. The podcast is LA Podcast. We have a lot of stuff to do this week, a lot of fun things to talk about. We have a great guest, Daniel Hernandez, the editor of LA Taco, is joining us to talk about some interesting things that LA Taco is up to, and also to talk about the USC scandal that I think we're breaking on the show. I don't think anyone has really gotten into it until now. People are too scared to touch it.
You will not believe what happened at USC.
I should say, I didn't really talk about it during the interview, so I'll say briefly now. I have a little insight into this because when I first moved out here, was a tutor in Brentwood. My wife and I moved to Brentwood to be closer to all the rich families that we could tutor. And this whole scandal has just made me realize that I was extremely underpaid. I really should, based on the kind of work I was doing, I should not be working anymore. I should have been able to retire.
Right.
I got $30 an hour.
Right.
When these people were making millions.
Recession prices, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I guess so. That's what it was. Mm-hmm. And I also had a friend who tutored all the Caruso kids. And he
did a very good job.
Right?
Why even waste money on tutors if you're Rick Caruso? Like, does it matter?
I guess.
That was plan A.
Yeah. he's a different breed of billionaire, I guess. You know? Let's tell some LA stories. Who wants to go first?
I can do mine first. Mine's
great.
Very brief. I want to follow up on my transit app success story.
Yes.
And just say, I've been super excited by all of the people tagging me on Twitter about how they're using transit app to become number one on their various streets. I mean, it's not Sunset Boulevard, of course. I'm still number one there. And
I
want to revisit a comment that Hayes made that my points were less valuable than Chuck E. Cheese tickets.
Yes.
I received a package in the mail last week from the transit app. We're in Chicago, I think, and they sent me a pair of Transit App branded socks, which is the kind of thing I think you could get for several thousand points.
Oh yeah, you'd have to spend at least an hour to get those points.
Just want to say they're not completely
worthless.
Does
that make you like a spokesperson? Are you?
Yeah, I didn't clear this with us.
Are they a sponsor of the podcast now?
I wanted to put it on Twitter with a hashtag ad at the end.
Spawn.
I want to shout out my friend Kevin Bartel. If you listen to Hollywood Handbook, you know him as Chef Kevin. He is the number one rider of the 180 bus line, and he's fifth on the 181. Question I had for you, Scott, about this. So you're number one on the two.
Right.
Does that mean if the 302, if the express bus is coming, will you let it go because you have points to build up on the two?
These are serious questions.
The answer is I ride in the counter commute direction. So I don't have an opportunity to ride the 302 almost ever. But I am, let's see, very low on the 4, 329th.
Oh, I'm ahead of you on the 4. I'm in the high double digits.
That's great.
He's so jealous. Seething. I have a good one. Last night, I was invited to, as a plus one, to a KPCC gala event at the Westin Bonaventure Hotel downtown. If you don't know it, it's the one that's like made of four mirrored cylinders and has elevators going up and down to the outside from a lot of different 90s action movies.
You definitely know it.
Yes, you
There's
definitely
recognize
it.
There's no one listening to this who doesn't know what
there
the
Bonaventure
is.
There was a fight scene in it in True Lies, I think. And go to this event. There were Javier Becerra was there, a lot of different people speaking. There was a Nobel laureate who was interviewed. But the whole night, Bill Davis, the like KPCC founder emeritus or whatever, and Herb Scannell, the new president, were talking about how excited they were for the band that was playing, which was a John 2 and his band JT and Friends. And I was like, okay. They were like really excited. They were like, can't wait to like dance, like cut a rug to John 2 and JT and Friends. And I was like, okay. Like, I don't know of this band personally, but I guess this is exciting. Can't wait to hear them. And then I read in the pamphlet for this KPCC gala that they have like the list of donors and stuff. And the number one donor had his own category of catalyst is John 2. And so I'm like, oh, that's interesting.
Pay to play.
This guy, it's literally pay to play. And I'm like, okay, this is kind of odd. So I Google this guy. This is the fourth richest person in L.A. He's a bajillionaire.
Uh-huh.
Actually, not in L.A. He lives in Rolling Hills, right. Which, if you're not familiar, is a gated city.
That is also a city.
It's a walled estate.
I always refer to it as a fortified neighborhood council.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's a good one.
And he founded Kingston Technology. They make flash drives. Make great flash drives. I have some. So the band comes out. He gets up there. I would say it was a 40-piece band, but might be more. They played disco. They played. They come out and play Do You Remember 21st of September? Right. And he is on an elevated platform playing the drums. This is a 78-year-old man. Is like the showcase of the event. Everyone's like looking at him, be like, "Yeah, John." As he like plays the drums for everybody.
Uh-huh.
He had different singers. For the first song, there were five female singers, and then four male singers come out to play the Bee Gees,
okay,
and sing "What You Doing on Your Back," and everyone from KPCC totally knew that it was time to dance.
Wow.
Literally dance for this man's pleasure. It was unbelievable. I this is not to disparage. This is just how the game works. I pray one day this podcast is successful enough that we can...
How the game works. This sounds
that we could dance, yeah, for the joy of a billionaire.
Lynchian, like, has a distinctly,
yeah, I want to know
Mulholland
more
drive,
yeah,
quality.
It was really incredible. The, he is a totally adequate drummer, I would say. Like,
so it's like his dream to be a musician, and so he pays to sponsor the gala so he can play at the gala
with these huge,
with a 40 piece band
bands. Actually watching him, it really did seem like you were living inside someone else's dream.
Uh-huh. It's like if David Lynch remade Blank Check.
Yeah.
I would watch that. I don't know if I would attend, but I would watch it.
It was great. I learned about this guy. He's richer than Eli Broad.
Well,
who I'd never heard of.
And Eli Broad has never been in a band.
Yeah, and Richard, and cooler.
Yeah, he does. He does way more boring stuff with his money.
He's never played at the Mocha Gala, as far as I know.
Or he's like, he's humble about it. He plays like underground, like secret shows.
Yeah, he only does.
At the Smell before that closed. He was always at the Smell on Main Street. Alyssa, what's your LA story this week?
I just wanted to talk about the butterflies because we haven't talked about it yet, and it's been
they showed
such...
up after our last episode.
I think they reached kind of a peak early this week, I feel like, and maybe the weather, finally the rain stopping and the sun coming out. But I had a hard time finding them at first.
I was gonna say you had a very sad tweet.
I've heard a lot of people say like, I haven't seen them, but you have. People are expecting the wrong sight. People are expecting, I think, like swarms of butterflies that will like block out the sun.
There were videos of swarms that people, they did look like. I took some pictures of, videos of birds, and I wanted to post it as like a joke. And then I realized that some videos actually did look like there were that many.
Really?
But they just fly really fast. But
they fly so fast.
I saw them the most, which was, I don't know if it's still happening, but you can ride down the path by the river and they're like coming at you like,
yeah,
you're in like,
oh, that sounds
hyperdrive
great
mode, you know. So but I just also love, everybody gets so excited about them and they're all over social media, and then there's like the backlash. They're like, well, they're kind of small.
Oh, yeah, and
they're
small,
not,
yeah,
that they're not as pretty as monarchs.
Whoa.
They look more like moths. And I was like, okay, people.
How do you have
a backlash
against a butterfly migration? What do people want? Jesus.
I heard that also people saying like, enjoy it now,
yeah,
because we're all going to be dead really soon.
Well, like,
okay,
are.
Yeah, I will. Yeah. Thanks. I will enjoy it.
I mean, the butterflies, they don't live very long either. They are dying. It's okay. But what a person that Jenna Chandler at Curb did a great interview with a bunch of scientists, and the one scientist was like, this is like a native thing that is natural and great. That it's like the one thing where like an infestation or too much of something isn't bad. It's actually fine. And, you know, we should celebrate that.
Yeah,
and so
they're not bothering anyone.
Yeah. In a week of, you know, they're pollinating, they're doing all this great stuff. They're eating, you know, invasive species of plants. And so we should just be really happy in a very horrible week. And some, by some measures, thank you, butterflies. I don't think you look like moths. I think you look good.
I wish they would like settle down for a second so I could really get a look at one.
They are. They flit.
They're in a hurry.
Extra. Yeah. I think they got it.
These butterflies are very extra.
Alyssa just called the butterfly migration extra. Early highlight of the year for me.
Let's get into some of the stuff that happened this week. A lot of moves on rent control from a few different angles. Scott, why don't you talk about the state legislature put up a bunch of bills, a very ambitious housing package designed to make renting more affordable. And just for some context for what's going on right now, efforts at rent control in recent months have not been successful. On the November ballot, there was, of course, Proposition 10, which was put up by the AIDS Healthcare Foundation, which would remove a state law that forbids the expansion of rent control. So that would have gotten rid of any restrictions on rent control. Cities could have expanded rent control as much as they wanted, but that proposition failed by like 20 points on the state ballot. So recent efforts have not been successful to do it on the ballot. And so now the state legislature is trying to jump in and do something about it.
Yeah. So I think that this is something that we've expected. I mean, prior to
this. This was a little more extreme than I thought. A little farther than I thought they would go, I guess.
So let's talk about the bills that we have. We did talk a little bit during the wind down of the 2018 legislative session about our expectation that we would see some kind of movement. And then at the beginning of Gavin Newsom's term at the State of the State, he actually said, you know, get me bills, get me an ambitious package, and I will sign things. So we expected some kind of movement. But what we got this week, as you said, is pretty strong from a legislative perspective. We have four bills that were just filed. One is from Richard Bloom out of Santa Monica. This is AB 36. And what it would do is basically allow for rolling rent control, which is a local law that would say as soon as buildings get older than a certain age, in this case 10 years, they would be eligible for rent control. It doesn't eliminate Costa-Hawkins, but it gets rid of...
It reforms Costa-Hawkins.
It does count as a reform of Costa-Hawkins because what the previous bill from 95 does is say that there can't be anything rent controlled in the state of California that is built after 1995. So this would eliminate that date and would say 10 years old. Anything that's 10 years old can be eligible for rent control.
That it doesn't impose that law, but it would allow cities
to make that change.
Yes.
And then we have Assembly Bill 1482, which would actually put in place a state rent cap, basically, or a rent increase cap. We have from Buffy Wicks up in the East Bay in the San Francisco area. We have a bill that would potentially create a registry of rental units. I think with the hope that having that data available would allow regional planning to be more effective, more efficient, basically. And then we have a bill from Rob Bonta, also from the East Bay in San Francisco, that would... this one is AB 1481, and this is another shot for the legislature at for-cause eviction. This
or
is something
just cause eviction. You've heard it. I've heard it referred to as well.
Which was something that they considered during the last session, and
I think
was
Rob
shot
Bonta
down.
Put that one up as well, which basically says that if you're going to evict somebody, you have to have a reason beyond wanting to charge more money for a new tenant.
Right.
And this is happening in California, Oregon just made a huge move to this effect that you wrote about very recently, Alyssa.
Yeah, Oregon passed a bill that kind of had all this wrapped into one. It was a rent hike limit and then also the same just cause eviction protections. And
for the whole state.
For the whole state. And it has similar, you have to live in an apartment for a year to be eligible. And then I think it's 15 years. The properties have to be 15 years old.
Rolling rent control.
Yeah.
After
so it's
15
rolling.
Years.
Yeah. So, but that, you know, still the fact that it's universal, that everywhere in the state, everyone's protected. I mean, this was such a huge victory for tenant advocates in Oregon.
And they weren't, were they just allowing cities to impose rent control, or they just flat did it?
It's not even just saying it's allowed. It's saying it, this is the law.
The properties
law.
Are automatically
this
rent
is,
controlled.
It's everywhere. Yeah.
This is like the CHU bill that we just talked about. This would basically say that anything over a certain threshold is
automatic.
Illegal. I think it's 7% their annual increase. So if it's within the definition of rental type.
Yeah.
And then also just this week, Elizabeth Warren, who is one of the presidential candidates, maybe you've heard of her. She had this great housing bill proposal and kind of like stepped it up. And I feel like it's because of this thing that happened in Oregon. There's other states that are 37 states do not allow rent control. Just let that sink in your head. Like, do not allow it. And even the four states, Oregon will be the fifth, that allow it. You have places like California, New York, where it's very
weak.
We don't allow anymore. Yeah, you don't allow anymore. But like also like in the state of New York, they only have rent control in the counties that encompass like the Manhattan and New York or New York City, you know, that whole region. So even places that have it, it's not very strong. To have somebody like Elizabeth Warren introduce maybe a national tenant protection, you know, this would be life-changing for, you know, so many people. And it is because of this groundswell you're seeing in these states where they're saying, okay, well, we're not going to deal with this anymore. We have to do something. So for California to follow now Oregon's lead, we might have been laying the, you know, groundwork for it. But now we're going to be part of this movement, hopefully.
Yes. Her housing plan also includes a lot of funding for construction of public housing.
Yes.
To editorialize, I think, a fantastic proposition across the way. And it got a lot more progressive with.
Yeah. And also I should note, Oregon, another bill was introduced that would do the same thing that we've talked about in Minneapolis and say that, you know, all land zoned for it's for cities that are larger than a certain population. I can't remember, but like, you know, most cities would have to prove that their land that's zoned for single family homes could be for what they're calling missing middle housing. So again, paired with those two things, maybe California could come up with something similar to increase our
and
housing
when you have
production.
All those render protections in place, like they now do in Oregon, it's great.
Yeah,
upzone
exactly.
to the sky.
Exactly. Yep.
I really wonder, like, what do you guys think as far as, so of the bills that we talked about today, what do you think are the chances for those to actually pass? Because we've talked about Bonta's bill already went down in the legislature. Have things changed substantially enough? This is a very aggressive set of reforms. I think it's great. I think that they all should make it into law during this session. But I do wonder what will become of them.
So for just cause eviction, they got that passed in city of San Francisco. I think the next move for that probably is not necessarily a state bill, but to get it done in city of LA, which we don't really, I haven't seen that
hasn't
effort
even been broached,
taking shape
think.
Yet. Honestly, that would be a great thing for the AIDS Healthcare Foundation to be using its money toward, which we'll talk about what they're doing instead in a little bit. I think Richard Bloom's rent control proposition, the rolling rent control eligibility, is a very smart compromise bill.
Something also that I forgot to mention in here in Liam Dillon's article in The Times is that AB 36, Richard Bloom's bill, would also allow for that rolling rent control to be applied to single family houses, which is currently outlawed by Costa-Hawkins.
Yes,
huge. But I know the California Apartment Association is going to fight. It seems like they're going to fight it. And they're using the failure of Prop 10.
Yeah, they sent a release that was just like, the voters have already spoken.
The voters don't want
this. We don't want this.
They're taking an extremely hard line on this, which is probably to be expected. I think their comment was basically like, we will not ever support any... any kind of rent control, blah, blah, blah. Like, however, I do feel like there is reason for tenants to be hopeful. We talked about the the national climate does seem like it is changing more in favor of tenant protections. Of course, San Francisco had victories locally last year. And I mean, I do feel like there is momentum to make these kind of changes in California. Yeah. I think to go back to the just cause evictions, the reason why that has not really come up in LA is because 75% of renters in the city of LA are covered by the RSO,
right,
which does provide just cause evictions. So
okay,
there's somewhat... I just haven't even heard any conversation about it. I feel like it is a good time for that to happen at the state level.
Because people are constantly talking about the need to get rid of the Ellis Act, which basically allows landlords to
right.
kick anyone out whenever they want to if they're doing a big renovation or getting out of the business or whatever.
And I think at the same time, we'll see, you said, you know, national climate's changing, but also very locally, we have cities that are really stepping up that what they can do within if their states allow right. these things. So like Inglewood last week or 2 weeks ago deployed this emergency rent control ordinance for 45 days, but they have the opportunity to extend it up to a year. And their council, I guess I just heard, I mean, not we know these things are happening. It's not heard, but like they had said, they heard instances of where you know, people were being kicked out and rent was being increased by like 130%. You know, these mm-hmm. ridiculous situations, and they're doing the same thing, limiting rent hike and then just cause you know evictions, and that would not be that hard of a thing for no. the city of LA to do if they
sure.
wanted to do something
no,
like
not
that.
At all.
Yeah,
emergency would be great too.
I think that's kind of how you know that the climate is changing because nothing else has really changed in Inglewood. Mayor Butts in Inglewood has been taking a beating on issues of displacement, evictions, rent hikes for longer than we've been doing this podcast, and has not been swayed at all by those arguments. So the fact that they're doing this now, when absolutely everybody who works at single city of Inglewood has known that these massive rent hikes have been happening,
yeah.
and have more or less been encouraging it to happen, yeah. And now they actually are taking a good decisive action, even if it is a temporary one, does signal to me that there is something changing.
Did you guys see the great article where they leaked a bunch of Irving Azoff's emails where they are so mad at James Butts because he wanted he emailed like various like Laker people.
Right.
The headline was like there was a plan to bring the Lakers back to the Forum, which was basically like, yeah, Irving Azoff, the guy that owns the Forum, had a plan for the Lakers right. to come back there. In other news, I have a plan for the Lakers to play in my living room. But they're so mad at James Butts for working with the Clippers to bring the Clippers to their new venue in Inglewood. And on these emails, they refer to Steve Ballmer as Balls, sometimes with an S and sometimes with a Z.
That's so great. I love that.
But yeah, I mean, part of me always wonders about the fact that all of this is happening on the state level when rent control is really only an urgency in certain parts of the state. And so I think this is a great opportunity for our new mayor, went out for a pack of cigarettes and has now come home to get involved. He said he supported Prop 10. He right. wants to be able to expand rent control in LA. If he went to Richard Bloom, went to the state and said, hey, you got all, you know, the 40% or whatever of you guys that are Republican, don't worry about this. LA wants this to happen. Allow us to expand rent control. I think the rolling idea is a great one. Like, just do a pilot program like they do for the keeping bars open until 4 right. a.m. Just, like, isolate it to the few cities that really, really need it. Try it out. And that's the opportunity for our local electeds to speak up and say that this is something that we really want. Because if we're not saying here, yes, do this for us and the areas that we really need it, then I think it's a lot less likely to happen. We should also talk about, like I promised. So you might think that the AIDS Healthcare Foundation would be thrilled that some of these measures that they have been fighting for rent control expansion, it looks like the state is like really trying to do this, that they would be excited about that. But instead, they are going to get back on the ballot and try and do the like effectively the same thing that they did last November again with a new ballot measure instead of supporting either A, supporting the like running a campaign to support the bills that are going through the legislature, or B, trying to expand rent control in places like Inglewood and Long Beach and Glendale and Pasadena, places where you could add thousands and thousands of new rental units to become rent controlled. They are getting back on the state ballot for 2020. Scott, do you have any thoughts on that?
Do I have thoughts on it? I think that basically Michael Weinstein has established himself as a political gadfly. There are a lot of ways that somebody with his means and connections could get involved in the political process, but he has chosen one in particular. He is not, certainly not a joiner. He is not interested in helping even things that seem ideologically aligned with what he says that he's trying to do get across the finish line. He has issues that he is really invested in financially and would like to make as much noise about as possible. I really don't know what else we can take from this. The campaign for Prop 10, which was put on the ballot by the AIDS Healthcare Foundation, was extremely costly. Something like $130 million by the time the campaign season ended on both sides. Although, of course, the pro was far outspent by the against. And it also ended up being a lot of energy and time spent by grassroots organizers, ACE, people that were actually not necessarily directly affiliated with the AIDS Healthcare Foundation, but supported the measure.
Yeah.
So it was a massive amount of resources spent. And Prop 10, of course, as we've talked about on this podcast, didn't necessarily come close to passing. And we've talked about how the statewide ballot measure is not the best way for something like that to go through. But this is like the lever that they have and that they seem to enjoy using. So
why? That's my question.
Because it's not, I mean, honestly, like you don't get famous or any kind of reputation supporting other people's work. I mean, there are like nonprofit organizations, like people that really care about a cause supporting bills going through the legislature all the time. You could be running ads if you wanted to, saying write your local representative, support these bills.
It just seems like a better use of money. Just seems like a better way to spend money.
As we've complained about before, don't let these local initiatives that are happening in cities around LA and the place where you are based, you just let rent control expansion initiatives just die on the vine because you want to put something on the state ballot. The state ballot is not only not the only way to approach this, it's probably the dumbest. It means that you have to go through a huge number of people of Republicans. I mean, the state is like 65% Democrat or something. So now you need to get almost all of just the people that are naturally favorable to a rent control bill to vote on something, especially in 2020 when people are going to
be a little busy.
Yeah. People are going to be showing up like from both sides. I mean, I guess if Bernie's the nominee and like lots of people are showing up for him, then maybe like I can see why you would hope to be brought in and like a huge groundswell there. But in general, there are so many other ways to spend this money that are more potentially effective.
The most favorable, and so we should say the Prop 10, the pro Prop 10 side sucked up $30 million, which was a huge amount for a state proposition. The anti got, I think, $100 million, something like that.
They were outspent by a lot.
Yeah, yeah. But that's just a huge draw of resources in general for something
and volunteer hours
for something that's not like a charter fight. It's basically unheard of for that many resources to go into one fight. That being said, I think the most favorable way you could cast this. Did we actually say what the ballot measure is?
Okay, yeah. So it's not exactly the same as Prop 10. Yeah. It's not a Costa-Hawkins repeal. Right. It's for vacancy control.
Right.
Or at least that's what they've been floating. It hasn't been officially announced yet. But it basically says that when a tenant leaves an apartment, right now you're allowed to jack up the price as much as you want for a new tenant. That's called vacancy decontrol. But if vacancy control were imposed, then the rent could only increase by a set amount when a new tenant showed up.
Which I think is good.
Yeah, great.
I think that is good. I think that this is not necessarily the best way to accomplish this. But I think the most favorable way to look at what Michael Weinstein is doing currently in terms of talking about this and saying, you know, basically this housing package better be strong or else we're going back to the ballot with this, is that he has already established himself as this sort of, I don't know, Baba Yaga of the pro-tenant left in terms of the amount of resources that it would take the California Apartment Association and their cronies to actually fend off a ballot measure from them. I think that it does make sense in a certain light, or at least if you are being charitable, to say that the AIDS Healthcare Foundation in doing this can say to, I mean, basically is intimating to the CAA and realtor groups that they should be less hawkish about not negotiating with the legislature. They should be more open to negotiating with the legislature, because otherwise they're going to have to go through the whole thing at the ballot again.
But I think there's a chance that the Apartment Association is saying, oh, we can go as hard with the legislature as we want. They're begging for the opportunity to litigate this on the ballot, because then they can just throw money at it and win. I mean, like, Michael Weinstein has never won one of these.
That's true.
These state elections. I mean, at what point do we stop like flushing resources into this?
I don't know. It is that the question is, like, is anybody really happy to have to spend $100 million in one election cycle just to maintain the status quo? I realize that we're talking about plutocrats and they have like potentially a ton of money at their disposal. $100 million is a staggering amount of money.
Yes.
And then to be talking about doing it again 2 years later, it's just expensive. It's not good for their business.
Maybe that's the strategy, is to just, you know, keep chipping away at the.
Yeah,
but
it potentially
then at least after two tries we can see what the trend line is. Yeah. Are we moving in the right direction? If we get like 43% this time,
forces people to the table. Also, one of the things we talked about with Prop 10 was that the like voting yes to repeal something was hard to wrap your head around, whereas this would be actually voting to say landlords can't increase.
That's still true. Confusing, though. It's always going to be confusing.
I confuse vacancy control and vacancy decontrol all the time.
But I think that there is, I don't know, I think that that is, it is less confusing.
It is clear, that's true. But I talked to a lot of, not a lot, but several housing activists, leftists. This is not like a many people are saying thing. I've actually talked to people that said,
many analysts are saying,
we got on board with Prop 10 because it's a cause we believe in. We wanted to get the word out about this. We did not think that this was the most effective strategy for getting rent control accomplished. The state ballot is not the way to go.
Local, yeah.
And that I'm curious to see if people fall in line and support this as loudly and with as much of their time and money as they did for Prop 10, if we go through this again, or if we can potentially find other.
Totally agree. I think that it does have potentially.
You're a great example. You spent many, many hours knocking on doors for Prop 10.
Yeah, I was leading a bunch of canvas events, and I feel very passionately about rent control. But I think that this going back to that was a very hard fought campaign for the people that were involved, and it was a very disappointing result. So I think that there are downstream effects that organizations that are not the AIDS Healthcare Foundation, as far as Michael Weinstein is concerned, it is like you were saying with the CAA, he is the money man. He is just like, I'm going to put this money out there, and then it's up to other people to get this thing done. And if they don't, then they're incompetent, basically, is his attitude. And I do think it has downstream impacts on people that are working in this space to have to or be expected to dedicate their energy and advocacy to this state ballot measure that has worse prospects than if we had, say, Inglewood, Long Beach, Pasadena rent control measures. And then how are we going to come up with grassroots activists who can dedicate time to both? Or maybe the local measures suffer unnecessarily because so much oxygen is being sucked out of the room by the state measure.
Yeah,
that is my concern.
This opportunity to me feels more like SB 562, the Medicare for All bill from a couple years ago now, that was not successful, but they got a huge amount of influential people on board in the process of like people getting energy behind it. Got Gavin Newsom supported it. It got through the Senate and then was sort of shelved in the House, I think, by Anthony Rendon. But it didn't take as much. It didn't cost as much. And I think it had about the same effect in terms of like showing that people were really passionate and behind something. Even if it weren't successful, I think these bills that are going through the legislature now are worth putting a lot of organizing energy behind to try and make happen. And I think they have a much better chance of happening than SB 562, for sure. Let's get to our guest. Daniel Hernandez from LA Taco is joining us on LA Podcast right now. Enjoy. Big get this week. We have in the studio Daniel Hernandez, editor-in-chief of LA Taco. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us. You have a long history as a journalist in LA. You worked for LA Weekly and the LA Times, correct? You were the Mexico City bureau chief for Vice News. You left LA and you lived in Mexico City for how long?
8 years.
You wrote
Eight
a book?
Years. Yes, I did.
Down in Delirious in Mexico City?
It was fun.
And now you're back. You got back a couple years ago.
I got back a couple years ago. Yes. I moved here back here with the Vice office. And then I left Vice and then,
he says with a big smile,
I was freelancing, worked for another little company. And then one day, just jumping right into it, Alex, the publisher of LA Taco reached out to me, called me one day and said, come on board and start publishing. And that's what I've been doing now for the past year and a half. So it was kind of a slow transition into this role where I just wanted to get back to LA and do LA stories and cover LA and cover the LA story and the California story. So it took me a while to get there, but that's where we're at.
I think the profile of LA Taco has risen dramatically since you came on board there. And I would imagine that most of our listeners are familiar with the site, but could you tell us a bit about LA Taco?
Yes. And thank you. And thank you for inviting me in that introduction, sir. LA Taco is a community-based news platform, culture. You know, we're not a nonprofit. We're not an accountability site. We are trying to carve a space that I think people, you know, value what they pay for. And I think that, you know, for now, we're just going to be a platform for the city and just trying to reflect the city as much as we possibly can. I remember even when LA Taco was very light, just to move back a little bit. And when I was in Mexico City, I would still check it, even if he was only posting because it was his hobby website, the publisher's, for many years. Even if he was posting a couple times a week, if I felt like I needed to check in with LA, I would go there. And I feel like actually a lot of our audience are from outside of California or many Northern California and other parts of the country because they like miss LA or they want to check in on it, you know? And so I feel like we're just providing that kind of a service, you know? Mm-hmm. And while the weekly is sort of in its, you know, dismantled,
whatever it is now...
You know, and the LA Times is rebuilding, and I think there should be this ecosystem. And however which way that we can contribute to that media, local media ecosystem is important, you know, like Curbed, like Everyone Eater, the Streets blog, people like, you know, all of it, I think is healthy.
Yeah. You started at LA Taco around the same time I think we started doing the podcast for the same reason, because we were watching all these local news organizations kind of fall away one by one. But yeah, you guys are doing great stuff. Probably your signature feature over the last couple of years is coming out next week. Is that right? The Rogue 99.
Thank you. The Rogue 99, edited by Catherine Spears, Tian Wen, is our restaurant guide. It's going to be amazing. Second edition. we are desperately looking for a sponsor at the very last minute. If one does not come in, we just believe in it. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. We will publish it out of our pocket because we think it's that important. And we think that I'm reading it right now. The ladies completely edit it independently. We sort of pay for it and we publish it. So they have complete editorial independence. And it's just, it feels like a breath of fresh air to read like a good restaurant guide for the city. One that's not too sort of catty or sort of insidery, but right. does sort of recognize that eaters in Los Angeles are extremely sophisticated at this point and recognize the worth and the value of not only a place like a very fancy spot that was in last year's list, Spago, mm-hmm. to like Mercado Olympic, which is the tianguis that happens every Saturday and Sunday on Olympic between whatever and Central, you know? So, and I can't reveal who's on the list, but sort of that range is yeah. really exciting. So yes, that's out next yeah. week, March 25th.
I have an idea for how you guys can make money off it. What if you went to the different restaurants and asked them to pay you in return for a oh spot on the list? And then you could throw a big event where Imagine you're that. Advertising all of them. Could be an interesting side angle for you guys.
How do you guys go about putting together the Rogue 99? Because is the intention to find the 99 best restaurants in LA no. most representative, or what are you looking for?
More along those lines. If you had to select 99 establishments where you to eat in LA that give you a portrait of LA through the culinary channel that we all have, I guess, what are those restaurants? Right. And I think it's also a combination of sort of iconic places that at this point are institutions. You know, I think last year, Grand Central Market, you know, Gelaguetza, those kinds of places that are sort of LA yeah. institutions, but there are also certain surprises and there are also, and again, the breadth of, Catherine Chen is pretty amazing. Like there'll be references to other restaurants in the blurbs to something that, and, you know, hearkening back to the place in La Puente that was open for two brief tour short years. And I'm like, that kind of knowledge base in LA is what we need of more and more, and just amplifying it as much as possible, you know? So, so that's what it's about, you know? And Taco in general, I would say, is kind of also
yeah,
just like my writers, some of them, I'll be like, okay, but do you know this about this neighborhood? And do you know, how this really interplays with this, if we're talking about the port or rail or home, or you know what I'm saying, or the political sphere, which I can't wait to talk with you guys about.
Yeah. Well, I learn stuff from it all the time. Just, you guys had a story this past month about how there are no Dominican restaurants in LA.
Shocking.
I'm from that Massachusetts is. Where there's like yeah, a huge Dominican presence. I always assumed that somewhere they didn't have their own neighborhood, but there was like a population here, but there isn't much of one. Was it like amazing. 0.5% of the Latin American community is in Los Angeles
County, 0.5% wow. in LA yeah. County, according to Pew Hispanic. It's an interesting sort of quirk, yeah. you know, New York, Dominicans are the second, third largest group right. on the yeah. East Coast yes. in many states. And so here to have no restaurant that does that, I found pretty shocking. Jessica Flores, she's a wonderful a grad student at Annenberg in journalism. She brought us that story. And I asked Gustavo Arellano, I asked Bill Esparza, I asked every food person that I knew on my mm-hmm. back end while editing this, like, are we sure? Are we
yeah.
prepared to
say? You don't want to say something about it and have someone pipe up and be like, hey, you forgot us. Yeah.
In a county of 10 million people, there are no Dominican restaurants.
Unbelievable.
It's pretty amazing. But yeah. I should go to the one in San Diego, actually, sometime. I should go check that out because they did discover one in San Diego. Beto Like identified one, which is that platform. But yeah.
Oh, okay.
So that kind of stuff is cool. You know sure. what I'm saying? Like, we're recirculating a story from last year about the Irish-Mexican connections
yeah.
historically in the border region. And so, like, today, St. Patrick's Day, like, so much stuff crisscrosses through Los Angeles. And it's like, if we can just throw in a little pebble into mm-hmm. the pool every day to help, I'm just glad we're able to do that.
Well, and I think you guys do that really well. Like, what you're talking about addressing... the absence of this sort of, you know, this popular LA that we all inhabit, that, like Hayes was saying, that's something that we care very much about too, rather than the more like rarefied sort of reporting that I feel like yeah. a lot of outlets focus on more exclusively. But like yeah. when you talk about like the Rogue 99 and how LA eaters are very sophisticated, I think you also, and Catherine does a really good job of this, but you guys do an excellent job of realizing that the sophistication of LA eaters is such that we know that it's not all the, you know, the Michelin star restaurants, right, if there were any.
Big asterisk.
I would just say, like the $4 sign Yelp, right, restaurants, right, are not like, yeah, necessarily where you're going to go. And so that's something that I feel like you guys have done an excellent job, yeah, of rooting the community eating places.
And also such a year to have it after Jonathan Gold's passing last year, which we, you know, I see his spirit in everything that you guys, it's kind of referenced, the Rogue 99 is referencing his list, yes, right? Yeah. So it's like, you're just taking his place basically. I mean, I don't know how those lists live on and who makes, yeah, those lists, you know, so going forward. So it's you.
I mean, we hope so, honestly, because someone has to do it. We have to honor J. Gold more than anything, the legacy and that bar that he established. And I just feel very fortunate to be there. I really feel that sort of at this point in my career, I sort of always wanted to, I'm passionate about Los Angeles. I feel so adopted by Los Angeles. And I finally feel like I'm more exactly where I need to be. You know what I mean? And so that's cool to try to help and then bring other people in and bring other writers in and sort of respect the diversity of voices that are present in LA. And on the news side, when people take action into their own hands, I think that is fundamentally newsworthy,
yeah,
and fundamentally relevant. And so I was trained as very classically as a journalist. I've never contributed to a political campaign. I've never volunteered for any kind of political organization at any level in the history of my career, because I've been that committed to the notion of journalist as a sort of a profession that you live in 24 hours a day. However, when people take shit into their own hands, mm-hmm, I think that's important. I think that's newsworthy at a community level. And so when people are advocating on rights and on tenants' rights, the homelessness, the housing,
street vendors,
all of that, we're going to take the perspective of the people who are at the base level. It just seems very obvious for the spirit of journalism. You know what I mean?
I wanted to ask you about, because you guys had a very early interview with Alex Villanueva. I think right after the election, I think that was one of the first times he was like on, yes, on video, and a lot of conversations about getting ICE out of jails and things like that. This was very, very early in,
yeah,
what's now sort of a new public persona for Alex Villanueva.
Yeah.
I just sort of wonder what you think about, obviously it's a complicated issue, but where, yeah, that administration has kind of been going.
Weird guy, I gotta say. Right. Kind of a weird, yeah, guy, but I respect him. And let me tell you why. I think that, first of all, the will of the voters in the sort of sheriff voting system that we have in this country, which is, we all know, rooted in the history of suppression of people,
yeah,
and, you know, the Reconstruction period, all of that, right? So we're elected by the will of the people. In some parts of the country, they elect radically supremacist, crazy, wild, racist sheriffs, like in Phoenix, like, yeah, Maricopa County or whatever.
Yes.
And in the other... anyway, so it's like in LA, the confluence of the exasperation with the political class, the true sort of ineffectiveness of the endorsement system,
mm-hmm,
coupled with era Trump, coupled with a midterm election in which miraculously Latinos actually did come out and vote.
Yep.
And coupled with the unfortunate and rather stupid tradition of just like looking for the Spanish surname and voting for that person as long as they're a Democrat. That kind of, those factors contributed to the election of this complete, actually rogue figure.
Yes.
And that a lot of people find very nerve wracking to deal with and to think about, because he seems to be quite isolated and not really sort of bought in or in allegiance with any of the standard, mm-hmm, power structures in the city.
Mm-hmm.
So when he reinstates a guy, a deputy who was accused of assaulting someone, or it was a domestic violence case.
Yes.
Reinstates this person, and then the county board of supervisors censures him. His attack line was, "You guys are politicians, and no one cares what you think." And that to me was like, boom, like we have a true disruptor here, because, right, that's exactly what the deep core LA County, Pomona, SGV, high desert, South Bay voter is probably thinking,
right,
whether they're Democrat or Republican.
I think that's a very good point.
And he's channeling that. So the particulars of whatever the craziness that he's doing, I'm just like, we elected you sheriff. You swore to be sheriff of this county. You swore to not permit ICE in the jails. And you said some very things that sheriff candidates aren't allowed to say normally.
Yeah.
And again, it's like it's disruptors, you know?
Yeah, I do feel like that that absolutely hits home for me, because to me, one of the things that has been such a through line in the history of LA County politics really is at least in the last 5-6 decades, we've seen politicians really, if not intentionally, suppress voter activism. They seem like they would be happier if voters kind of didn't pay attention to things that were going on. And I think that that is ultimately fairly dangerous for, as you were saying, like the established political order, because if you end up with a wide gap between what voters think, how they see the world, and how politicians see the world, then you're absolutely right. You end up in a situation where voters are saying, well, the politicians are telling me that this guy is bad, or the Times editorial board is telling me not to vote for this person, but I don't care what their endorsement is, because they don't represent the world that I live in at all.
Totally.
The thing that still scares me a little bit about him is you're totally right that he is a rogue agent and is resisting the county, the board of supervisors in a way that we've never, it's like pretty much unprecedented, this relationship, but he's an agent on behalf of deputies and it seems like to give them more leeway in how they interact with people that live in the city with civilians. And so it scares me.
I don't know about that.
Well, just that like he is trying to get rid of constitutional policing committees that, I mean, like he basically wants to defend deputy behavior. Right. Like I think his reinstatement of Karen Mandoyan is a great example of that. He wants to bring back a lot more deputies that were accused of misconduct. So I worry that he'll end up in this kind of, like basically take the sheriff's department to what the LAPD has been in the past and have it be like this isolated strike force that can kind of get away with whatever it wants. But I think a positive thing to come out of it would be,
but it already was that,
it
right?
Totally was. Yes, absolutely. Yes. And a lot of this stuff coming out in the open, it's the Trump thing, like you're saying, like he's making plain a lot of the way like things have been all along.
Yeah.
And if it means that the county comes down on the power of the sheriff's department a little bit, I don't think that would necessarily
we need to re-examine thing. Him Philippa Glauer, the reporter who got that interview, had been cultivating a relationship with Villanueva since the campaign, because I was like, let's cover this guy. Like I'm getting wraparound ads on my Sunday LA Times every day for weeks saying vote Jim McConnell, and everyone in LA that you think is a leader is saying vote for Jim McConnell.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, let's cover Villanueva. And so ever since that interview, he has not given the LA Times an interview.
Yeah.
He
was the last one.
He didn't give Spectrum. Spectrum asked us for our footage. I know Maya Lau, the sheriff's reporter the LA Times.
Yeah.
Great person, terrific. I've actually known her since she was a fifth grader.
Wow.
We went to the same middle school and elementary school. So it's amazing to see. And she was like a dancer when she was young. It's amazing to see her.
Yeah,
become,
she's been on the show.
Now she's a dancer of facts.
She is.
And we mentioned her stories probably
and
like
she's
twice
so
a week.
Dogged. Yeah. And it's like, he's already built a wall around himself, and I don't think he's going to do press again, or not for a while at least.
Yeah.
So we'll see. But we do have to keep an eye on him. And thank you for reminding me about.
No, I wasn't trying to do that. I mean, I think it's like a difficult thing to examine, especially because the precedent in the McDonald administration was not great, and it's still
and Jim McDonald's a fine person. Have you met him or talked to
Never
him?
Never met him.
His sort of heart is in the right place,
Boston
but
guy.
He's still sort of defending rights. So he's still sort of defending the status quo of deputies and law enforcement is always right. Always, 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 always. And we defend the rank and file. And that's it, because that's the way it's been for 150 years.
Mm-hmm.
So his hands are sort of tied essentially to a certain point. But I don't know.
Let's talk. You mentioned the USC Annenberg School. Let's talk a little bit about what's going on at USC this week. Everyone has heard this story. Felicity Huffman and Lori Loughlin paying off like guys that run a business essentially getting your kids into school by any means possible, saying that they're on the crew team or the soccer team, bribing coaches, huge amounts of money thrown around to get kids into USC.
Remarkable story.
You wrote a little bit about the specific story of Lori Loughlin's daughter, Olivia Jade, being on the yacht of Rick Caruso.
It's
unbelievable.
And Rick Caruso is on
the president, new president of the board of trustees at USC, who was brought in to clean house and turn the ship around.
And he's close to everyone, right?
Everybody.
Caruso. Seems like it.
I was reading up on him. I didn't really know his whole story, but his dad founded Dollar Rent-A-Car. Mm. He was the youngest city commissioner in LA history. Tom Bradley appointed him when he was 26 to be a DWP commissioner. So, yes, he knows, it's totally in his blood. And knows everyone, I think, not just on the political side and in the community of like really rich people. His kids are really out there in like the celebrity world. One is like a DJ, one's a director. And Olivia Jade was friends with his daughter, Gigi Caruso, mm-hmm. who is now like, I think, a bikini designer, who's 19 and going. She somehow managed to get into USC. It's just a window into a process that we already knew was pretty corrupt. I think everyone who goes to USC could kind of tell you that there's this subculture of unbelievably rich kids, who kind of exist in their own social circle there. But you talked to some people for your story, some like college counselors.
Yeah, I mean, I did talk to a few counselors, and I spoke to another one actually after the publication story, a recent interview, and I think they're just like, everyone knows this kind of stuff was happening. And I think that there is now, obviously, one of the many issues that's being questioned and opened up is the question of ethics among these for-profit college counselors. Mm. And I spoke to one who was like, look, this is what I do. You know, many of my clients are middle class. Parents, they might be immigrants from China or India. You know what I'm saying? He really, and I think there's a soul searching happening in that kind of industry about what are the limits and what should be the ethical limits. I think there should be very clear ones, obviously, about this highly competitive market, because that's practically what it is.
Yeah.
And for me, it very opened up the failure of the Cal State and the UC system to adequately satisfy the needs of our education needs. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? And I, just for my personal history, it's like I graduated in 1998 from high school. We were in the first class after Prop 209,
right?
Admitted to the UC. Our numbers dropped. African-American numbers dropped 80-something%, 85% from one admit class to the next. Uh-huh. Latino numbers dropped 60-something. You know, it's like, and now we're remembering this period of affirmative action and how it has reviled and how it was sort of dogma from the 90s through the Bush years, basically through today, that affirmative action is a horrible, terrible thing. And it's like, wait, there's been affirmative action for the class that already has the leg up.
Yeah, right.
For decades. And not only that, but it's literally a value to be bought with enough money. And mm-hmm. so I think
UCLA has like a vanishing black population now, right?
I would imagine and it's like, what are we doing, and what does our state need and how can we bring up more people and really actually level the playing field? And everyone is kind of at fault. Like, I had like a Latino super cool conscious like optics college counselor who was mm-hmm. like, just go to the junior college for 2 years and then we'll transfer you to state or UC. And I'm like, I don't want to go to the junior college. I want to maybe like go to college and you know what I'm saying? So there are we are being channeled in different ways and funneled in different ways, and it needs to be stopped. And I'm just glad that it's being exposed.
Yeah.
I think the big question for me is like, what happens now, and how does this in the long term, how does something like this lead to change in the way that these exclusive schools carry out their admissions? Because it does seem like everything that we've seen in the past year or 2 years out of USC, it's just been scandal after scandal. It doesn't seem like there's a clear line of accountability for a school like USC, where there is something that can actually force them to change. It's all perception. Does the perception get bad enough that they have to do something about it?
And they're so powerful. Look how much of downtown they control now.
Yeah, and they have basically...
And the political infrastructure of the city is made up of people who are very close to USC alums.
Are you counting the Grove and Americana annexes in that too? I mean...
Mark Ridley,
did you go to USC?
No.
When I was shopping for colleges, they invited me for the weekend to, I got into Annenberg, right? They invited me for the weekend. And I just remember being so creeped out by the whole thing.
Right.
By the time it was so cultish. And the idea, what mostly, and this is granted, this is 20 years ago, but what they were mostly selling you was the option of joining the Trojan family and thereby having, and I'm sorry to expose this to Trojan readers or whatever listeners, but like, thereby having an ultimate professional network that in Los Angeles is the cream of the crop. And they really actually do have an alumni network that is really committed to sort of helping each other out. And for a lot of people, I think they see a degree from USC as a kind of investment in this future network.
Absolutely.
Of people, which is admirable and impressive in its own way. Is it, you know, intellectually,
right,
morally or ethically cool? Maybe not so much, but it is what it is, you know?
Yeah, there's a few things going on for them. I mean, you have to wonder if they would... So, like, they're so focused now on bringing in, especially, like, wealthy foreign students that brings in, like, a huge amount of money for them. And I think that's a big reason why they've established basically a security state around USC to show, especially after the woman was killed a few years ago near campus, to show that it's safe to send your kid there. But that happened again this past week. Somebody was, like, a student was murdered just off campus.
Son of a City of Oakland councilwoman.
Yes. And so at some point, the whole premise of USC is being undercut from all sides in terms of, like, why to send your kid there. I wonder at what point they start entering, like, an existential crisis. I'm sure that, I mean, they have access to money from so many different sources, but I mean, you look at the Board of Trustees, it's a lot of Trump people. Miriam Adelson, Sheldon Adelson's wife, is on the USC board.
Really?
Yes. the public storage, the guy that founded Public Storage and his daughter, who are both, like, giant Trump boosters. It's kind of like, it seems like they are having to go to sort of undesirable places to maintain the access to money that they may be losing.
But it's not just Trump people. Like, it is.
It's not just Trump people. Rick Caruso is a Republican, but he is not a Trump Republican.
It is basically just like the top level of most of the most prominent corporations in and around LA. Yeah.
And Bryan Singer.
Dang, what a crazy scandalous place.
Yes. We've been shocked just since we started doing the show how often USC comes up, and in so many different flavors of scandal, just like every possible kind of thing that could a university could be subjected to within the past year, it feels like, has
so crazy.
They've just shuffled through.
I think it comes back to what you were saying, Daniel, which is like, What do the students of California actually need? Do they need... I think when you talk about an institution that operates on the basis that what we're offering you is the opportunity to be part of the Trojan family, and that is going to set you up with benefits that you would not necessarily have for life, that comes with its own sort of... In order to sustain that, that has its own exigent needs. I feel like that frequently is something we talk about as leading USC into these ethically... treacherous waters. It's just weird. Is that really
the athletic
what
department?
Right. Is that what students in California really need? Is the opportunity to get basically like backdoored into this like high class lifestyle, or do we just need more opportunities, as you were saying, in the state system and the UC system that would allow for high quality education? The sort of democratization of opportunity, but not just because you know somebody who knows somebody. know?
Well, I think there's a couple of layers to it. There's the athletic department, and that level of corruption is so extreme and insane. And it happens even at like second tier schools. Mm-hmm. You know, the recruitment process is entrenched in every kind of possible kickback that is permitted by the letter of the law. Mm-hmm. And then some.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Like, everyone has probably heard stories of like basically high school recruits like getting like prostitutes and getting like getting drunk and dude, like at all during the recruitment process, homes being offered to the parents. So the whole thing that happened with Reggie Bush at USC 5 years, 6 years ago.
I thought it was funny when they took down his jersey, which was only a few down from OJ Simpson's, which stayed up.
Still up.
Oh my god! So I think there's that element, and I think there's going to be a lot of looking in the mirror, hard looks in the mirror for people who have interest in, you know, the Brentwood schools and the Santa Monica schools and the Palisades schools, and like, we're going to have to figure out, you know what I'm saying? Like, first of all, recognizing and acknowledging that there is this sort of tiered structure, and then I hope putting more pressure on the state to truly fund the systems properly and to expand them as our population needs become more and more evident. Like, UC Merced is already like super full.
Right.
Yeah. And it just opened, I don't know how many years ago, but they just graduated. You know what I'm saying? Like, we need more of these schools, and they should also be in an ideal world, you know, and also, you know, the UCs are also like kind of lack in kind of a lot of ways. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? Cal State's no se diga, you know, of course they do. And the community colleges, you know, they're all...
Where a study came out just a few weeks ago that, 20% of students are homeless in the community college system in LA. And college used to be free in the state of California. Not even that long ago, right? I mean, you could go, tuition was free. I mean, we have gotten so far away from that. And it's because people who own their homes in these places... haven't paid their
don't gesture at me.
Taxes.
I'll gesture right back at you.
I'm not gesturing at you. Oh no, not gesturing. I wasn't gesturing. It was a general like Prop 13 hangs over all of us.
Oh, yes, totally.
I know, and you're such a Jarvis man. Like, you just love.
That's me. I'm a Howard head.
That's what we have to do, right? Repeal Prop 13.
Yeah,
and get those monies back.
Yeah, it is interesting that as you know, as we get, I mean, we're like basically now. What, almost 40 to 40 years past the passage of Prop 13, a lot of the demographics of the state have changed. And not only have the demographics changed, but the demographics of political power have changed in the state. And it is interesting to see these conversations happen more and more openly about Prop 13, which used to be something that people wouldn't even discuss in private as far as political actors go. But it's the people who passed Prop 13 and gutted school finances are then the same people who 20 years later did 209 and said, you know, we don't have enough money to let all the people who deserve to go to the UC system in. And so we no longer want to do affirmative action because like some people don't deserve it as much as others. So there was racism at the start. It continued. We've now have a system that is badly underfunded. And I feel like it is only now that we're beginning to seriously reckon with the legacy of, all of the terrible things that came out of all of the tax cuts in the 70s. So,
but do you think we're ready to repeal that, or the state? Why has it not, why have they been unable, or whoever has been unable to do it?
I think the strategy for 2020 is a smart one, which is they're doing split roll, which is they're just going to repeal it for commercial properties. I think that's a good way in. That's a good start to repealing the whole thing. But then you don't get as much anger from homeowners who don't want to pay higher taxes on their properties. I think it'll be easier to get done in a piecemeal fashion than it would be to just blow it away completely.
Howard Jarvis, the Taxpayers Association has been militant about this since the 80s. They've been saying as soon as they come for split roll, it is a sign that they're coming for homeowners next. So
yes, I'll openly say that that is correct.
Howard Head in residence.
But it's going to be a fight no matter how you do it. I think the reason why we haven't seen movement on it so far is because still to this day, a lot of the, locally speaking, a lot of the most powerful groups are homeowners associations, are people who have long tenure in a certain location in a city, and also are disproportionately whiter, wealthier, much more so than the average person in California. And they just have more access to politicians. I think that has slowed down the rate of progress. But at the same time, now we are actually seeing the median voter in California, I think, move further to the left on issues of taxation, yeah, social services. And we have had politicians, even in areas that are wealthier and whiter, come out and say Prop 13 needs to be seriously changed, if not repealed. So as far as I can tell, it seems like the dam is breaking, and that is something that has been encouraging to me.
Not a third rail anymore. People can actually talk about it.
Yeah.
Well, we've come to the repeal Prop 13 portion of every interview.
Where everything comes back to.
Every segment we've ever done, which means that we can end it. Daniel, thank you so much.
Thank you, guys.
Everyone, become members of LA Taco.
Yes, please do. Thank you for mentioning that.
And read the Rogue 99. Yeah. This is coming out tomorrow, so will it be out this? What day? You don't have to promise anything.
It will be before the end of March. We'll have the Rogue 99 out. And also, mark your calendars for Taco Madness 2000.
Yeah,
which is going to be at La Plaza de Artes y Culturas once more on May 4th. So mark that now. It's really fun every year.
Thank you, everyone, for listening. Thanks, we'll be back next week on LA Podcast. Bye.